You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to a Stoughton native who has made a living collecting VHS tapes of awkward or bizarre videos and presenting them to appreciative audiences all over the world.
First, as a candidate, Donald Trump took aim at the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. He promoted a plan he called health care reform to make America great again, which promised a repeal of the Affordable Care Act on day one of his administration. Here's Trump a few days before the election speaking in Pennsylvania.
When we win on November 8th, and elect a Republican Congress, we will be able to immediately repeal and replace Obamacare. Have to do it. I will ask Congress to convene a special session so we can repeal and replace.
President Trump went on to say that this would be done very quickly.
Now that he won the campaign, Trump has been quoted saying he might just amend the law. Donna Friedsam joins us now. She's the Health Policy Programs Director of the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute and an expert on government-sponsored health care programs in Wisconsin. Donna, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good to be with you.
Well, the Affordable Care Act, it's got a lot of pieces, a lot of moving parts, fairly complicated. What would just flat out, first of all, repealing it look like? How much of a drastic change would that be?
Well, it would be quite dramatic. We have in the country over 20 million people that have coverage through various provisions of the Affordable Care Act. And here in Wisconsin, we have 225,000 people who have Obamacare related policies, as well as people who have other coverage that they got via certain provisions linked to Obamacare. So it would really have significant impacts if there was just a straight out repeal vote that happened tomorrow. However, that there's essentially no chance that that's going to happen. So it's not something that we need to worry about.
And now here's a clip of Donald Trump talking to Leslie Stahl on the CBS show 60 Minutes just after the election, talking about components of the Affordable Care Act he would like to see stay in place. Here's a listen.
When you replace it, are you going to make sure that people with preconditions are still covered?
Yes, because it happens to be one of the strongest assets.
You're going to keep that.
Also, with the children living with their parents for an extended period, we're going to...
You're going to keep
very
that.
Very much try and keep that. Adds cost, but it's very much something we're going to try and keep.
Now, that's where it starts to get tricky, isn't it? The pre-existing conditions mandate, you can keep your parents' coverage for a while. But then we had the mandate that was part of what helped pay for all of that. How does that work if we repeal part of it but just keep those parts?
Exactly. The part that's very popular with the American people is the part where insurance companies were not allowed to exclude people based on pre-existing conditions, nor could they price people out of the market based on their pre-existing conditions. As well, people liked the provision that young adults could stay on their parents' policies through age 26. Now, you really can't ask insurance companies to take all comers with whatever conditions they bring unless you assure that insurance companies will get healthy people to enroll as well. It's kind of like asking insurance companies to let homeowners buy home insurance while their house is on fire. It just doesn't work. So the way that the Affordable Care Act functioned was based on a number of interrelated provisions. And what the Republican reformers are now looking at is how to create a new system of coverage that would allow these very popular provisions to remain, but not having the less popular provisions stand while still making it a viable insurance market. And that is a very big challenge. And that's why what President-elect Trump is learning is that it will not be possible on day one of his administration to repeal and replace Obamacare.
What kind of things are Republicans in Congress talking about replacing all or part of the Affordable Care Act with?
So there's various things that may happen. There's certain steps that can be taken over the next several months and, in fact, the next year and are likely to happen. But everything will be very gradual. And before I even get into that, I want to emphasize for your listeners and for consumers that may be thinking what's going to happen to my coverage, that right now the policies and plans that are available through the Affordable Care Act for 2017 remain available for 2017. And so do the premium subsidies, the tax credits that are available. So anyone that needs coverage should be going through the open enrollment period right now. And that open enrollment period will end on January 31st. So if they have a policy right now that ends on December 31st and they need coverage to start on January 1st, people should go to open enrollment right now by December 15th to renew their coverage. And nothing has changed. The plans remain the same. That the same plans that were available before the election are available now, as are the financial subsidies. So that's important for your listeners to know. Having said that, there are various discussions underway about how to change certain provisions. Now, Republican reformers have talked about, you've probably heard about selling insurance across state lines. You've probably heard about going to high deductible health plans that include HSAs, and as well removing some of the financial subsidies and increasing moving high risk people into high risk insurance pools rather than keeping them in the same insurance pool with the rest of the insurance buyers in order to try to make insurance less expensive for younger, healthier people. So those are some of the things they're talking about. And there's a number of plans that are out there. They all differ. But there are two really main plans that people think are going to be the template for reform. One of them comes from House Speaker Ryan, his Better Way plan. And those provisions in the Better Way plan are what many are looking at as how the discussion may proceed over the coming year, and I'm happy to explain how that may go. But I should mention that there are as well other plans out there. There's one from Orrin Hatch of Utah that has a lot of discussion as well, and there's several other plans out there. So it's going to be a challenge over the next months and year for the Republican leadership to coalesce and come to some agreement about what they think is the best way to proceed and then gain enough Democratic votes to pass a replacement bill.
Talking to Donna Friedsam from the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute about the future of health care in America, the Affordable Care Act. And, of course, the Affordable Care Act is just one piece of the puzzle. Medicare, Medicaid, we're already there. They're still there. There's talk of changing some of the benefits to a block grant. Governor Walker has called for that, hoped for that in the past, saying the states would have more flexibility. What are the prospects for something like that? What would it mean?
So a Medicaid block grant differs from the current program in several respects. The current program is structured as an entitlement, which means that enough money becomes available as there are people who are eligible based on the guidelines. So the program grows as the enrollment grows. And it's structured as, this is kind of complex language, but in a counter-cyclical way it works. So the more people need the program, the more the program grows. So in times of economic setback during recession, when people lose their jobs and have lower incomes, generally those are larger number of people that need these kinds of programs. That's when people enroll in the programs more. That's when more federal money becomes available because more people are enrolling, and it's an entitlement to that coverage. And then when the economy improves and more people have other options through employment and the like, they disenroll from the program, the expenditures in the program naturally shrink. So in that way, it's a counter-cyclical program. Under a block grant, states instead would just get a set sum of money based on their historical spending, and it wouldn't change, except it would be tied to some inflationary level that would not be the same as the medical rate of inflation, because the federal government is trying to cut its investment in the program. And that amount of money would not change based on the needs and the demands of the population in terms of enrollment. So in times where there was an economic setback or a recession, as more people enrolled in the program, states would not have any more money from the federal government than they had during economically stronger times. And so they would have to figure out how to reduce expenses in the program.
In a sense, they'd have to ration health care under those conditions.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So as we wrap up, can you talk about what we in Wisconsin in particular should be watching for as changes are made or contemplated to the Affordable Care Act, given the particular ways we've interacted with that legislation?
Right. I think it's going to be really important for us to understand how it's going to affect the hundreds of thousands, really, of people in our state who have enrolled in the Affordable Care Act plans, and almost 90% of those people are getting the premium subsidies that are available through the Affordable Care Act, so they won't be able to afford those plans if those premium subsidies go away. So it's going to be important for us to be listening to how the reform plans will affect people who receive premium subsidies. Currently, the premium subsidies are linked to income, so lower-income people get higher subsidies and higher-income people get less subsidies. A number of the plans don't link the subsidies to income, and so that'll be something to be listening for. In terms of Medicaid block grants, Wisconsin is going to be wanting to pay attention to how large the Medicaid block grant will be, how it will be related to the number of people enrolled in our state, how it will relate, what is the base going to be, where they're going to peg the number related to our historical spending, how will that account for changes in our enrollment, and whether we'll be able to continue to maintain the payment rates to providers if changes in the economy occur. Will we need to be reducing payment rates to providers, cutting services and benefits and the like, or how will we be able to adjust, what kinds of reform plans will the state have for managing that set sum of money?
A lot of questions to watch for in the future. Donna, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Donna Friedsam, Health Policy Programs Director for the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute, looking at the future of the Affordable Care Act.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we hear about potential conflicts of interest between President-elect Trump's business empire and his role in the White House.
First, many of us have seen them, funny or awkward video clips from late-night public access TV, corporate training films, goofy exercise videos from the 80s. They might make you wonder, who thought this was a good idea?
Our next guest has made a living collecting and presenting these bizarre videos to appreciative audiences all over the world. It's called the Found Footage Festival. Showing is coming to Wisconsin, Madison, and Milwaukee this weekend. Nick Pruer is originally from Stoughton. He joins us now. He's the co-founder and co-host of the Found Footage Festival. Nick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
How did you get started on this road, collecting these mostly VHS videos of weird stuff?
Well, I think like a lot of, you know, the great ideas, it came from being really bored teenagers. And we were looking for something to entertain ourselves in Stoughton and the early 90s. None of us had driver's licenses. So my buddy Joe and I would go to thrift stores and look for old VHS tapes that people didn't want anymore and try to find stuff on there to make us and our friends laugh. So we'd have people over to, you know, my parents' basement and watch these tapes and make, you know, a running commentary of jokes. And that's essentially what we're doing now. But, you know, now we have 6,000 plus videos in our collection to draw on, and it grows every day.
Does it surprise you, the stuff that people film and think someone might someday want to see for some reason?
Yeah, consistently. I mean, you would think we've been collecting for over 20 years and touring for 12. And just when we think we've seen everything, we're, you know, surprised by something that was deemed worthy of putting on tape. Like, we found a video called How to Spot Counterfeit Beanie Babies. That was deemed worthy of an hour-long instructional tape about, you know, how to spot a counterfeit beanie baby.
You know, we've got the internet now. We lost you for a second there, I think, Nick. We've got the internet now, and people are videoing themselves, doing lots of stuff, posting online. But looking at some of these VH videos, man, there's something special about the weirdness that went on to those that I don't get in internet videos. What is it about that medium of the VCR tape?
Yeah, I think it was just a moment in time. It was sort of a new format, and so people were trying out new ideas, and there was still a naivete about how the format worked and what you could do. So there's a lot of experimentation, a lot of mom and pop operations, and I think, yeah, it was new. People didn't know that this stuff would be seen years later, so they were willing to try a bunch of weird ideas. And I think now people are more savvy. So, you know, if somebody's making a YouTube video, they know it's going to be seen all over the world, and there's sort of a savvy that comes along with that. That I don't know, maybe it's not as endearing as the VHS era.
Nick, I want to get into some of the tape that you show, the video clips, and let's start with the video dating one. I'm assuming everyone in the clip is still single. We don't know that, but I'm a pretty good guess. Tell us about this one.
Yeah, this is a video that been lucky enough to meet other video collectors, and this one came from David Cross, the comedian and actor, and he got it from an editor friend who was living in California and apparently worked for this company called Video Mates in 1987. So before Tinder or anything else, you would make a video, a 30-second pitch as to why people should want to date you, and there's a lot of sweaters and a lot of really questionable decisions about what to include in these descriptions.
All right, here's a listen.
Hello. I like an attractive woman, someone who might look like Christie Brinkley or Jacqueline Smith.
This is a very exciting time for my life because I'm just starting a new claims adjusting business.
I have a very strong sense of humor. I've read recently that everyone thinks they've got one, but my friends do agree that I do.
Kind of your typical research mathematician, I guess.
Walking down the street or just going out for letting me take pictures of her with my camera.
I'm a ham. I've been on Jeopardy.
I decided that I'm lonely, but I'd love to go roller skating.
Co-ed bubble bath sounds like a real fun idea I want to try out.
I seek a person who is childlike.
Somebody that'll embarrass you by ordering too much food or, you know, somebody like that.
Basically, that's what I'm looking for. Thank you.
I think it's important to point out that the research mathematician was dressed as a Viking. I don't know, that doesn't come through on the video.
Yeah, that's a visual thing. But yeah, you can just tell there's a lot of, I think like a lot of our best clips, it's funny, but there's some pathos behind it too. So you really kind of feel for these guys.
And there's another one here that you feature of a singer named Harvey Sid Fisher. What's the story behind this guy?
Yeah, he's a singer, songwriter, and amateur from Los Angeles who was really interested in astrology. So he wrote an original song for each sign of the zodiac and went down to record a video demo to send to producers. And I guess the funniest part to us is he brought along interpretive dancers to help him with these songs. So you won't see it, but in the background there are people interpreting his lyrics.
We'll give a listen to clips of those here. Harvey Sid Fisher.
Talking about the Taurus, talking about the bully boo boo.
Bully bully.
Talking about the Taurus, talking about the bully boo boo.
Bully bully.
Lib, lib, Libra, lib, 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 I'll flirt and conquer, then withdraw. Lib, lib, Libra, lib, 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 then maybe might come back for more.
I was born a Capricorn. I was born a Capricorn.
So yeah, and the interpretive dancers add a lot. We are talking about the Found Footage Festival with Nick Pruer, originally from Stoughton. Some of these people have become famous, I think, in part because of the found footage. I saw the movie about Winnebago Man, a salesman who went viral, ended up a movie, and the movie includes him appearing at the Found Footage Festival. Can you tell us about this sort of accidental celebrity?
Yeah, you know, we were working, Joe and I were both working in Minneapolis on TV commercials as like production assistants and things like that. And whenever you're on a crew, we would always share the stories of the worst shoots we were ever on. And so we met a camera assistant who told us about a shoot he was on in 1987 for Winnebago RVs, like a promotional video, an internal video for salesmen. And the crew realized that the host had this terrible temper and he kept losing his cool. And they just couldn't believe it, so they decided to leave the cameras rolling and capture this man's descent into madness. And the thing that like we appreciated about the video, and they gave us all the raw footage, was that he wasn't just angry, but he was an artisan of swearing.
Yeah.
Like he was just had a way with words and expressed anger in a way I'd never seen before. So, and yeah, luckily for us, we were able to track him down and meet him, and it was like one of those like career highlights for us.
Well, right now we're talking with Nick Prewer, co-founder and co-host of the Found Footage Festival, which is coming to Madison and Milwaukee, November 26th and 27th, respectively. And we've got another clip to listen to. This one was hard to stomach right before Thanksgiving, but tell us about Chef Keith Gerke.
Oh, well, yeah, this isn't found footage, but it comes from our love of awkward footage and awkward television. And instead of finding it, we just kind of created our own. So a couple of years ago, we were back in the Midwest for Thanksgiving, and we thought it'd be funny, instead of promoting our show as ourselves, we would try to book a fake person on morning news shows in the Midwest. So I posed as a rock and roll celebrity chef called Chef Keith. And I'd just written a cookbook about how to spruce up your holiday leftovers. So we sent press releases. I got booked on 6 different morning shows and wore a chef hat and made some of the grossest concoctions I could think to make, and then would try to get the anchors to try them on air. And all but one of them did, happily.
Here's a taste.
So this morning you're in luck. Chef Keith Gerke is here, author of Leftovers Right, Making a Winner of Last Night's Dinner.
I'm self-taught. I did not go to culinary school, and I'm kind of unorthodox. Are you familiar with G.G. Allen? Do you know?
Can't say I am. Tell me more.
Okay. How about a mashed potato ice cream cone? What do you think about that?
That's fun.
All right. There's a statistic.
G.G. Allen. We'll stay away from any food involved with him, and the ice cream cone and the blender. Briefly, as we wrap up, you are from Stoughton. Do you like getting back when you're on tour with Found Footage to Wisconsin?
Oh, it's so much fun. Yeah, we had it was a real honor because one of the first videos we found was a McDonald's training video that I found in the break room of the Stoughton McDonald's about McDonald's custodians. And so we were in Stoughton last time, and my old McDonald's manager came to the show, and we got to interview her about, you know, what she remembered about that tape and about me as an employee. And so it always comes full circle when we're back in town.
Oh, Nick, it's been a lot of fun. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Nick Prewer, co-founder and co-host of the Found Footage Festival. You can catch the Found Footage Festival live on November 26th in Madison and November 27th in Milwaukee.
Coming up, we take a look at concerns over potential conflicts of interest between Donald Trump's role as a businessman and his role as the next president. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tonight after 7, it's Latino USA. Tonight, a Latino Republican looks at Donald Trump's immigration promises. The ACLU talks about possible legal battles, plus more in the run-up to a Trump presidency. That's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, President-elect Donald Trump is well-known for his business dealings in the United States and around the world. But as he gets closer to being inaugurated as the next president, there have been concerns about potential conflicts of interest between his old job, leaving the Trump Organization, and his new job, leading the country.
According to the Washington Post, Trump's real estate, management, and branding empire has business interests in about 18 countries and territories, from India to Saudi Arabia to Bermuda, and his family is expected to be influential as he prepares for office, too. The president-elect named his oldest children, Ivanka, Eric, and Donald Jr., to his transition team.
Terry Sullivan joins us now. He's associate professor of political science at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, also executive director of the White House Transition Project, a multi-institutional project preparing both the major presidential candidates, the president-elect, and the outgoing president for the transition. Terry, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Well, Terry, how big a problem could some of these business and family ties be for Donald Trump when we look at perceived conflicts of interest?
Well, they're, of course, complicated by the fact that that a lot of his business dealings are overseas. We've had other presidents, like Lyndon Johnson. I'm from Texas. Lyndon Johnson's family owned a television station, which was regulated by the federal government. And so there are precedents for how to deal with some of these conflicts. He wasn't directly involved in the management of the company, but his wife was the principal stockholder. And so there are, you know, solutions. It's not like we've never faced this kind of problem before. It's not completely unprecedented.
So when you say how to deal with some of this stuff, what is in the toolkit for how to do just that? I don't know if there should be a firewall or if there should just be ways of managing both of them. What do you think?
Well, the principal objective of conflict of interest legislation is to assure the public that the decisions of the office holder are independent of their own personal business gained or losses. And that's a pretty common strategy for dealing with conflict of interest. And so I think it's certainly the case that we've had secretaries of Treasury like Robert Rubin who had enormous holdings of stock and so would be making decisions that would affect the value of those stocks. And so we've had a lot of experience over time dealing with the notion of conflict of interest and its effect on government decision making. So I'm not sure what all of the concerns are out there in the world. I think the biggest concerns have to do with not so much conflict of interest, but whether or not the president-elect's business is pretty much a family business. And in that way, he's kind of like a lot of small businessmen who depend upon their closest relatives, their family, to help run the company. And in that way, I guess he's different from a lot of these major conflict of interest issues like Robert Rubin had as Secretary of Treasury.
But what happens when you've got some of those family members, you know, not just helping run the business, but also installed perhaps in advisory positions or maybe official positions within the White House administration?
Well, so, you know, one question is there information that is available on national affairs that is not widely held and therefore someone in the White House who especially has a national security clearance, for example, might know and that would affect business decisions, especially for a business that is like real estate is, you know, dependent on it's a fixed asset. You can't move it around. It's not like investments in stocks, which you can move in or out of. You can't physically move the asset. And so that poses a problem. And I think that's the issue that people are most concerned about is what do we do with a president who closest advisors are also family members, but they're closest advisors because they've had a long association running a business together. and that, I've stepped off into depths that I don't really know the depth, what's down there. It's hard to say for me to... It's hard for me to say what is the right answer, but it's not like we don't have people who deal with this all the time in government. The Office of Congressional Ethics, the Office of Government Ethics, the OGE, deals with this kind of problem all the time. And we'll eventually have a solution for it.
We're talking with Terry Sullivan right now, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, talking about the presidential transition in light of the various possible conflicts of interest issues that could arise for President-elect Donald Trump. And to continue in that same vein of thought, looking at family possibly being involved, there were some eyebrows raised, some concern when Ivanka Trump sat in on a meeting with Prime Minister of Japan and Donald Trump in terms of, you know, security clearance, national issues. Should there be cause for concern there?
Well, I don't know about cause for concern at this point. It would be a very big difference, cause for concern, if Donald Trump was the president rather than the president-elect. We have one president at a time. The decisions made and the promises made by the president-elect to the government of Japan are less important than the same utterances made by the president of the United States. It's uncomfortable that people who not simply didn't have national security clearances but also don't know that much about the economy as someone who is a chief advisor to the president might know, who's talking to one of our principal trading partners and one of our chief allies. So, yeah, that's a troubling thing to see, but I think it's more speaks more to the president-elect's inexperience in dealing with these sorts of issues. You know, they also didn't have talking points from the State Department, so that this all of this sort of transpired before the president-elect was really up and running in terms of dealing with the federal government and the government that he's going to manage and its relations. And that's not a completely uncommon experience, unfortunately, in transitions. And the thing that happens often in transitions is that people, regardless of whether they're governor or a senator or a member of the House or a businessman or whatever, it's often the case that they and their staffs make the mistake of thinking that whatever it is they have been doing is something akin to what it's like to be president. The president is really different from everybody else in the world. The job is different. The scope of it, the scrutiny involved in it, the scale of it. These are things that no one is really prepared for. And it's really important in that environment to take to be cautious rather than presume that you're up to this.
Terry, are there laws in place to limit the overlap between the actions of a president and his or her business dealings?
Sure. There are lots having to do with conflicts of interest. And there are also the ones that have been most mentioned recently have to do with the application of conflict of interest to relatives and whether those relatives are immediate family relatives or connected by marriage relatives and what kinds of jobs those conflicts of interest regulations are applied to. So, for example, you know, there's nepotism, which is one form of conflict of interest. President Kennedy appointed his brother to be the attorney general, and that was before we had these sorts of complex federal statutes. And that raised eyebrows. Robert Kennedy, you know, was not a long practicing member of the federal judiciary. He wasn't a member of the bar for very long. And so being appointed as the chief legal officer of the government was kind of an unusual thing, but it was what President Kennedy thought was a good way of bringing his brother in as a counselor, given the array of issues that were important at the time. And almost all of those issues were under the purview of the attorney general, having to do with civil rights legislation in particular. And so he thought that was a good place to put his brother as a counselor. Since then, statutes have prohibited that kind of appointment, mainly because it's part of his immediate family, his brother, and it's part of an important federal agency. So those are some of the most important issues to date. But we have other conflicts of interest. We have a basic theory about conflict of interest, which is that we want people to understand that the things they do as part of the federal government, as office holders, are going to be transparent. The public's going to find out about them. And the idea there is to deter those office holders from making decisions in the past or in the future that would call into question their making the right decision in terms of the public's interest as opposed to a decision driven by their own personal interests. And that basic theory about conflict of interest and how to regulate conflict of interest through transparency is effective when it's applied to office holders who can anticipate making future decisions and being held accountable for those decisions. It's less applicable to a new administration as it comes into office because the decisions that have been made in the past have been made outside of government when one could imagine that you weren't going to be held accountable in a sort of transparent way for those decisions. So the whole notion of deterrence in the executive, especially during a transition and during the beginning of a new administration, the deterrent effect of conflict of interest legislation is kind of moot. And the Office of Government Ethics understands that and has often recommended to Congress changes in our basic ethics legislation. But the Congress has found it hard to allow the executive branch to be governed by different standards than they are themselves as office holders governed by.
Terry Sullivan is with us right now, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, talking about the presidential transition in light of various conflicts of interest, potential conflicts of interest issues that could arise for President-elect Donald Trump.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest about the transition, how it works, how ethics guidelines, conflict of interest laws play into these things? Do you have concerns about potential conflicts of interest between Donald Trump's role in business and his role as president? Were they on your mind when you were voting? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we're picking up our conversation right now with Terry Sullivan, Associate Professor of Political Science and Executive Director of the White House Transition Project, which helps prepare the president-elect and the outgoing president for the upcoming transition. We're talking about that transition time and potential conflicts of interest as President-elect Donald Trump prepares to transition to his job in the White House.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. How do you think a president should deal with their outside interests, their non-government interests, business in this case, while in office? What are you looking for as this transition goes on in terms of ethical behavior from the president-elect and the people around him? What questions do you have about how all this works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
And we take our first caller now. We have Frank with us in Burlington. Hi, Frank.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Regrettably, we've only got less than 2 months now before the president-elect will be sworn in. And I mean, I believe that there are ethical concerns. As a citizen, I mean, what can be done if there really are these concerns in such a short amount of time?
Frank, thank you for the call. And Terry, what about that? What would the recourse be? Is it up to Congress?
Well, basically, we have a set of standards, and there's an Office of Government Ethics, and they're responsible for working out a relationship. And I guess working out a relationship in terms of how to deal with these potential conflicts of interest. We've never had, I mean, we've had presidents in the past. For example, I talked about Lyndon Johnson. His family, he had a family-owned television station, and it was essentially the only television station in Central Texas. It was very profitable as a family business. And, of course, television stations are regulated by the federal government through the Federal Communications Commission. And so there was lots of a potential conflict of interest there. The president appoints the commissioners. And so what was done in that situation is that the president entered into a blind trust. There were people appointed, a former judge in Texas, who were responsible for maintaining the financial well-being of the broadcast company, and the president basically didn't know one way or the other how the company was doing, so that there was distance between the decisions the president was responsible for, and the benefits that were accrued to the president from his private business. So it's possible to come up with those things, and the Office of Government Ethics does it for thousands of federal employees who have business affairs before they come into the executive branch. So we have a lot of experience with dealing with this, and it's just a thing that has to be worked out. And they're always worked out under these demanding time constraints. So especially at the beginning of administration, there are lots and lots of – there are – you know, he's going to be appointing lots of people to be Secretary of Treasury, to be Undersecretary of Treasury, to be the trade government's trade representative. All these people are going to have business backgrounds. They always do, even in Democratic administrations. They always come from business, from Wall Street, and so they have these complex financial personal financial affairs, and they have to be resolved, and they're always resolved by the Office of Government Ethics within a fixed amount of time.
Well, thank you for that call. Appreciate that. And we go next to Bill joining us in Stoughton. Bill, hi.
Hi there. Someone had told me that once Donald Trump becomes a president, he has to cut all of his personal ties with any of his businesses or whatever. Is that true? Does he have to totally be disconnected from his business, or what's the deal with that?
And maybe what about the issue of a blind trust being part of the picture here, Terry?
Well, he doesn't. If the caller means, does he have to say sell all of the stock in his company or relinquish his ownership of his company? The answer to that is no. He does have to separate his decision making from the benefits that he receives from his corporate activity, and therefore activity that would be affected by his decision making. That's the principal issue here under conflict of interest, is to guarantee to the public that the decisions he makes are made in the public's interest, not in his own interest. You know, we don't elect these guys to manage what Idi Amin called a kleptocracy, the object of which was to steal as much money from the people as you can while in government. That's not the objective of the American government. It's not what the people are expecting from their leaders. And so we have complex regulations that help assure that the decision-making made by the president and his staff are independent of their personal interests. Now, that, you know, they still have personal policy preferences. They still have personal ideals. They still have personal ideas about how the economy works, even if those ideas are often not accurate. So they're still going to be guided by their own ideas about how things work. We're not asking them to give up their intuitions. We're not asking them to give up their ideals. Eventually, all we're really asking is that there's some firewall between their own personal interests, their own personal direct interests in the decisions they make and the decisions they make.
And Terry, I think we're going to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate your time today.
Well, I'm happy to do it. Wisconsin Public Radio has asked us to come on after every one of these transitions, so we're practically kissing cousins.
We're continuing the tradition. Terry Sullivan with us there, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's also the executive director of the White House Transition Project. It's a project preparing both major presidential candidates, the president-elect and the outgoing president, for the transition, the upcoming transition. Join us there talking about that transition and also potential conflicts of interest issues arising around president-elect Donald Trump. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farah. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.